Hello, my name is Olivia Harding, and I am the host of Folk Files, a podcast that explores the tangled history of folk songs. Every month, I choose a topic to dive into for about 20 to 30 minutes. The subject of each episode could be a song. In the case of Shady Grove, a lot of people believe that it is a later version of the English folk song Matty Groves, but it's not that simple. A general topic. The main theme that I saw while researching folk songs about birds from all over the world is that many of them include nonsense syllables meant to represent the bird songs. Or a question that I want to answer. There has never been any real question that Black people were central to the development of this musical style. So why do we still picture white men hauling on the rope when we think of sea shanties? Press play and join me on a journey through the origins of murder ballads, sea shanties, rebel songs, and other music that has withstood the test of time. Folk Files is so pleased to be the newest show to join the BGS Podcast Network. Find us at thebluegrasssituation.com or where you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Chiefs on Broadway. There's a different way to experience live music in Nashville. Eric Church's Chiefs on Broadway is home to the Neon Steeple, an intimate live music venue in the heart of downtown Nashville, where artists and songwriters take the stage for up-close, unforgettable shows. From stripped-down sets to surprise guests, no two nights are the same. Check out the Neon Steeple lineup and get your tickets now at chiefsonbroadway.com.
They say there's nothing new under the sun, and ain't that the truth? The Working Songwriter has been on the air for over 10 years and 300 episodes now. As you've probably noticed, only the latest 100 episodes are available in your podcast app and on Spotify. So we're bringing back some of the gems from past years. Of course, if you want access to every single episode of the show at any time, you can become a member of The Vault. What is The Vault? The Vault is a private, members-only section of my website, joepugmusic.com, where you can access any episode of the show for streaming and for download. In the meantime, we're bringing back some classic episodes to the main feed. Is that a reason not to join The Vault? Of course not, because it means that our latest episodes will only get paywalled all the sooner. Is this a relatively convoluted system? Of course it is. But such are the trade-offs that the ever-changing media landscape leave us to navigate. Thank you for being here. It's always an honor that you listen to the show, and I hope that you enjoy some of these classic episodes. Today's episode with Marcus King was originally aired on December 18th, 2020. Our guest this week is a native of Greenville, South Carolina, who has a rich family history in music. Marcus King watched both his father and grandfather carve a path in the music business before he himself dropped out of high school to pursue his own star. It proved to be a prescient decision as he has rose to national prominence at lightning speed over the last few years, culminating in a Grammy nomination this year for Best Americana Album. He's built a reputation as a prolific touring act, playing as many as 140 shows last year before COVID brought the industry to a standstill. He has shared the stage with Jason Isbell, Josh Ritter, Chris Stapleton, and many others. He's a recording artist for Fantasy Records, alongside label mates James Taylor and the Tedeschi Trucks Band. The Washington Post has called him a guitar phenom. And Chris Stapleton has described Marcus as one of his favorite artists. The New York Times has said that he channels the musical spirit of generations past, including the Allman Brothers, Otis Redding, and James Brown. Marcus and I were able to catch up on the phone this week, and he told me about his journey so far. Marcus King, thanks so much for being a part of the Working Songwriter podcast. It sounds like growing up, you didn't exactly have a typical childhood. You had a childhood just steeped in music, your family and otherwise. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about how you grew up and how music was a part of your life as a kid?
Yeah, absolutely, man. I was really blessed to grow up around a family of musicians and folks that appreciated music if they weren't musically inclined. My grandmother, who we just lost, was a really big fan of Dean Martin and Perry Como, and I would listen to the crooner stuff with her. And my grandfather would later teach me about George Jones and Willie and Waylon and all the others, Charlie Pride. And that's the kind of music he played. And my father, you know, was a blues nut, still is. So I had a lot of different music to learn about at a young age. It was wonderful.
And I understand that your dad played with gospel acts as well. How did the church impact the music that was around you and the music that you would end up playing?
I think the most impactful part of the church growing up in a Pentecostal environment was not as much the music. Of course, it had a huge impact on me and the way that I approach things. But what was more impactful to me was the preachers on Sunday sermon and being around people that could speak with such conviction and really, really mean every single thing that they say and really try to pull emotion out of you. That's what I carried with me into the live performances that I do, is that if you're going to say something, you should really, really believe 110% what you're saying.
And do you think not only the performance, did you take that into your writing in a way? Did any of that steep into the lyricism you bring to things?
Yeah, I think that's a fair way of putting it for sure. Once I started writing, I quit keeping a journal. You know, I quit keeping anything like that, because that's all that writing was for me. It was just kind of an open book, and it's always made me more comfortable to just be able to say everything that's on my mind to whoever would listen.
You're obviously known for playing guitar, and in a lot of your bio and backstory, I've read that you started playing guitar early. When did songwriting come into the equation, though? Did that happen immediately, or pardon me? When did songwriting come into the equation? Did that happen immediately, or was that something that came along later?
Songwriting for me came a little bit later. I had always played guitar since I can remember, but it wasn't until I was about 13 that I started writing. And, you know, that was just a lot of trauma, you know, just a lot of things that you go through as a kid. I lost, like, my best friend in a car accident when I was 13, and that was kind of it for me. I just needed another source of creativity past the guitar. I needed another source of relief, and that's when I turned to the pen and the paper, and that's when I started singing, too.
Was that an easy transition for you, or was it rocky at first?
Well, you know, I mean, the voice is like a muscle, and the songwriting is a muscle. You have to build it, and it comes with time. You know, it's something that I still work on, and guitar playing the same way. But, yeah, I mean, it felt natural, but, you know, just like everything else, it was just as rocky as anything.
It's funny you mentioned that you kind of got into it from that good friend of yours that passed away. There is something about writing music for people who aren't here anymore. At least I've noticed in my own life, there is something about that in your own heart can kind of put a button on things, can kind of put a little bit of closure to it. Did you find that at all?
I do. I do find that with my writing, and I write a lot of songs about people that we've lost that aren't with us anymore, and it's particularly harder when it's people that had so much more to give, you know, and it is a good way to find some closure, you know, past the funeral or past the wake. It is a sense of closure. That's a good way to put it.
It is tough when someone goes before their time. One of the guys that I toured with the most when I first got started, when I was about your age, was Justin Townes Earle, who just passed away. And you know, I just kind of had the same feeling when he passed away a couple months ago, of just like, you know, it's always a tragedy when someone leaves, but when they leave and you feel like there is still a lot left to give, I mean, damned if there isn't just a bitter taste in your mouth afterwards.
Entirely, man. I agree with you entirely. And, you know, I've lost grandparents that were 90 years old or even further up there in years. And, you know, they will explicitly say, you know, I'm ready to go. And it hurts. It hurts really bad still, losing someone that you care about so much. But when you lose someone that's young and still has so much life left to live, it can almost make you angry. But in those losses, I feel like we create a lot more. We almost feel like we have to create twice as much, you know?
I know what you mean, and I know there's something about the reason I really like writing songs is it's not like writing a newspaper article or something like that where you're trying to get at some definitive account of something, because the feelings that you're talking about losing a friend like that, like they're more ephemeral than that. They're more they're harder to understand, and in that way songs can kind of touch on something infinite. You don't have to actually say the thing in a song and it still gets across.
I agree with you. I think that's a really great way to put it, man. And that's how I've always kind of approached my writing. And I've got songs that have no, you know, particular rhyme scheme. And at first I was kind of, you know, bashful about that. But if that's the way that it needs to come out of you, I think just do that. As long as it's got a, you know, as long as it's listenable, you know.
Yeah. Well,
what you need to say.
Have you ever had it happen to you that you write a song like that and you don't realize it until someone points out later that none of it rhymes? You're like, oh, damn, well, it sounded like it rhymed to me.
Yeah, no, it was actually a song of mine, Goodbye Carolina, that I wrote about a friend that I lost, actually, a couple of years ago. And it was pointed out to me like a year after releasing the song that the second verse really has no rhyme scheme at all. And I thought, that's a, you know, that's interesting. I could have swore it did.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, usually that means that there's a... It's funny, man. The older I get and the more that I write, I find myself doing a lot less editing. I don't know if you've ever done this before, but I found myself... I would edit and I'd get a song to a point where it was technically perfect, like everything rhymed, but the song just sucked after that. You know what I mean? And so do you find yourself doing too much editing before, or do you kind of go best idea or first idea, best idea? What's your kind of way that you work?
My process has always kind of been, which I think a lot of folks are like this, but when I'm on the road or if I'm at home, you know, I kind of just jot down little ideas here and there, or I'll put down a voice memo. I'll put down a melodic idea or a lyrical idea, and then I'll kind of lock myself away for like a week or two. I have a few spots that I like to go to write. And this is where I just kind of pull out all my notebooks and all my voice memos and start weaving this tapestry of all these ideas. And things start to make sense. You know, I feel like an old detective connecting the yarn on the thumbtacks on the wall. And it all kind of comes together and it makes sense. And I think it's because at my core, I kind of have an unhealthy habit of just repressing my emotions and not addressing them immediately. So I think that's kind of indicative in my writing style too.
There's nothing unhealthy about that. It's just called being a dude. It's funny. I've never heard it kind of described like that, like you're a detective, but I know what you mean. It's almost like you're trying to listen to what your unconscious has to tell you.
Yeah, and you need a special place to do that, for sure.
What are those places that you find yourself going to?
Man, as long as I can be next to nature, as long as I can get out and walk with my bare feet in nature and feel the serenity of earth around me, it's a really grounding thing to do. So I've got, you know, a spot out in California I like to go to write, up around Malibu. And you know, if I can get out in the woods here in Tennessee, that always does me right.
That's the way to be. So you you must have been chomping at the bit when you were younger to get going, because you just dropped out of high school to start working on music. Can you describe the process of deciding to drop out? Because that's a dramatic decision, wouldn't you say?
I would say. I watched my sister drop out, and I knew that she had done it for the wrong reasons, you know? Mm. I love my sister dearly, and she's a wonderful person, and but I know at that time she had done it for the wrong reasons, and I knew that if I was going to drop out of high school, it wouldn't be for the wrong reasons. While I was in high school, I was, you know, I was the only long hair there, and I was not really, I was not fully welcome there. I could have been more welcomed, but I didn't really have any school spirit. We'll put it that way. So
fair enough.
I wasn't really the favorite of any teacher there. Actually, there was one teacher, Miss Young, who I'll call out, who was actually pretty kind to me, and she actually had a Justin Townes Earl poster on her wall.
Oh, there
and,
you go.
You know, she probably listens to this podcast, so hey, Miss Young. She was always really kind to me, unless I was sleeping. But I remember that was the only teacher I liked, but everybody else, you know, couldn't really stand them, didn't really get along with anybody. I knew what I wanted to do was to play music. So I spoke to my parents about it, had a really nice conversation about it, like, I think this is what I want to do, you know, and they gave me their blessing on it. It wasn't like I was dropping out so I could just be, you know, a punk and just be a dropout. That's not what my intentions were. So the decision, there was a lot of thought that went to it, but as far as my guidance counselor was concerned, she didn't know about my intentions of playing music professionally, and she told me I was going to end up in prison, which I thought was a little extreme. And I didn't, thank God. But what I did was leave school and got my GED immediately, and then I went on the road shortly thereafter and just stayed until I'd say about 8 months ago when this pandemic hit.
Yeah, I know. You've been a busy man the last few years. So can you kind of explain to me, I think our listeners really love to hear, explain to me the nuts and bolts of what you do, you know, the day after you get your GED to start putting this on the ground. You say you took the show on the road. How did you put a band together? How did you start putting tours together? How did you start building an audience? What did that look like to you?
Well, for me, man, I kind of started this all when I was about 13, is when I kind of started the process. I was lucky enough to be in my father's band up until that point. And I played drums for him or bass for him, but mostly I'd play guitar with him in his full band. So I got to see him, you know, kind of run a business. Well, he did. He ran a business. He had, you know, his merch booth, and he had gigs. He would book them. And I learned from him a lot in that way. And what I learned early on was, all right, now I'm starting to get about 14, 15 years old. I got my what do you call it? It's a driver's license, but it's a temporary license.
Learners, yeah.
You know, a learner's permit, yeah. So I could only drive during the daytime unless I had a licensed driver. So I was like, all right, I'm gonna hire older cats to play with. So I always have a licensed driver in the car. So I hired older cats, and a lot of these guys had like wives and families, you know, kids even. So they needed to work, and I was booking us like 4 and 5 nights a week. And this is all while I was in high school, and I would provide the PA, you know, we were working really, really steady, and I was just going as far as I could out of South Carolina to where I could still get back and make it to school on time the next day. You know, that was kind of my hustle, was just go out and play as many nights of the week that I could keep us booked. I had us 2 house gigs a week, one in North Carolina and one in Greenville, South Carolina. I just keep us busy, and once I started booking us out of state, I kind of created a false alias that I would use to email clubs, you know, Robert was his name. And I would use that name to kind of reach out and make us look a little more professional than we were. But that's kind of how it started. And we had a buddy of ours, actually, that gave us a hand when I was about 18. He told us he would pay for us to cut a record of songs. So we went out to California and cut Soul Insight, and he loaned us his Suburban, and that was our means of transportation for at least a year.
Oh, man. There's a great divide between bands starting out, the bands that go with the white panel van and the bands that tour in Suburbans. I feel like that's the main divide.
Well, I'll have to say, we kind of split that divide because we did the Suburban and we got the Ford E350 one year later after the Suburban broke down on us at least four times.
Well,
we got in the white van. That was our transportation for easy 4 years, man. It was wonderful.
Oh, yeah. I've done my time in those. You know, it's so funny hearing you talk. It's like you were talking about having those teachers and barely being able to stay awake in class. But then you leave high school, and the work that you're talking about doing, going out on the road, booking your own shows, probably acting as your own TM, all this type of stuff, that's hard work. And it's funny, like, when you're having to work doing someone else's thing, it makes you go to sleep. But if you're working, if you're hanging your own shingle, it's like it gives you like a superhuman energy to work.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're miserable a lot of times, but it's a labor of love. You know, it's the same reason we carried a Hammond B3 long before we were on a bus and long before we had any kind of crew. We always had a Hammond B3 with us because we just appreciate the sound of a real Leslie shooting the sound around the room, you know?
Yeah.
We just appreciate real analog gear, so we had to work to get that shit in the house or in the venue.
Indeed. And you were saying you learned a lot from your old man. What do you think your dad's greatest strength as a band leader was and something that you took away from him?
My father's a tremendous listener. As a performer and as a human being, he listens to what people have to say on and off of the stage. And, you know, let's not forget he's a phenomenal guitarist. And he's a great singer, too. He's always been really not so sure of himself as a singer, but, you know, everybody always enjoys hearing him sing. He's just, you know, he's always been one of my favorite performers to watch. And, and he gave me the confidence to go out and be my own man. You know, he was really proud of me for making that decision and that leap. And he was proud of me, you know, for leaving school because, you know, and I know I'm going off topic a little here, but it was hard to leave high school, not because of my high school, but because in the afternoon I would go to, all the other kids would go to vocational school and learn how to weld or hairdress or whatever, which are all great professions, but I would go and study jazz theory at the Fine Arts Center in Greenville. And I did that for 2 years, and I could have gone another year, but I really wanted to leave and go on the road. And my father supported that. And between him and my grandfather, I had just a lot of support. And my grandfather was a real stern dude. Mm. We lost him when I was 14, but he taught me. Yeah, he was a sweetheart at the house, but when he was out on the road, he would teach me these little tricks like, if they don't want to pay you, just start taking their PA. You don't have to actually take it, but they'll wise up once they see you're taking their PA. And I was like, all right. And I tried that, and that ended in a bar brawl when I was like 16. And that's how I got started.
Come on, Grandpa, you got to give me better advice than that. Are you, what's it
well,
been?
Yeah.
What's it been like for your dad to watch this arc of yours over the last, you know, 5 years to a decade? I mean, from those gigs at 13 years old to now Grammy nominated. I mean, how is he processing all this stuff? Are you still able to rely on him for advice and stuff like that?
Yeah, absolutely, man. I think my father always has sage wisdom and sage advice. And, you know, even if it's something that maybe he didn't particularly have to deal with in his career, just his opinion on the matter is still going to be, you know, really useful to me because I just like the way that he processes things and the way that he breaks things down. So it's just a blessing to me to have my father and the rest of my family so supportive And so, you know, just champions of mine. My dad's still like the head of the fan club. And if you get caught in the elevator with him, man, if you didn't know who I was when you got on that elevator, you will know by the time you get off. He just, you know, that's just how he is. And I'm so thankful to have him.
Have you ever had this happen to you? You casually mention to a friend that you're thinking about getting into gardening, and then the next time you open up your internet browser, you're bombarded with advertisements for Mr. T chia pets. That phenomenon can be explained by the internet maxim, if you don't know what the product is, you are the product. Why is Google search free? Why is Facebook free? It's because when you use their services, your browsing history and online data becomes the product for them to sell to other companies to advertise to you. Well, to hell with that. Your online data should be private and yours alone. So what do you need? You need a virtual private network that protects your online data. NordVPN runs in the background while you go about your online business and keeps your data private. It doesn't log any of your activity, and it encrypts your data to provide online anonymity. Listeners to the Working Songwriter podcast can go to nordvpn.com/TWS, the initials of our show. That is nordvpn.com/TWS, and you can get a special Christmas deal. Every purchase of a 2-year plan will get you an additional 4 months for free. Just use the promo code TWS at checkout. From a very young age, it sounds like Marcus displayed an unusually strong ability to stay focused on his career. That kind of devotion is necessary to be successful in any line of work, of course, but it seems to be especially necessary in entertainment. The arc of a music career isn't a straight line heading up at a perfect angle. It is not parlaying a job in the mailroom of a company into a job on the sales floor and then into the corner office. It's a much more winding and jagged road. Success is never assured in a business where the quality of the product is so subjective. And you never know when the wandering eye of the zeitgeist will land directly on you. So it's all the more important to always be vigilant, to always be working at your top capacity so that you're prepared when the opportunity does meet you. There's a wonderful poem about maintaining that steadfastness by John Keats. It's entitled, Bright Star, Would I Were Steadfast As Thou Art. Bright star, would I were steadfast as thou art, not in lone splendor hung aloft the night and watching with eternal lids apart, like nature's patient, sleepless eremite, the moving waters at their priest-like task of pure ablution round earth's human shores, or gazing on the new soft-fallen mask of snow upon the mountains and the moors. No, yet still steadfast, still unchangeable, pillowed upon my fair love's ripening breast to feel forever its soft fall and swell. Awake forever in a sweet unrest, still, still to hear her tender taken breath and so live ever, or else swoon to death. Talk to me then. You have a band with a lot of long-time tenured members. So what is your general philosophy as a band leader? And are there things that you watched your old band do and you say, I love you, Dad, but I'm going to do it a little bit different. I'm going to run my own shop a little bit different.
Well, I think having a tight ship is really really important factor on the road. It's I tried for a long time to keep it as much of a democracy as possible, and you know, at a certain point, it just doesn't work when you have that many cooks in the kitchen. You know, I realized that I gained more respect from my band and even the tenured members that you mentioned. I gained more respect by taking the reins and kind of saying, this is what we're going to do, and giving them less to think about, really, and giving them less to worry about. And they just know they have to show up and play this instrument. And I just kind of took the reins as a leader. And in that way, I was a little different from my dad, because my father always wanted to just be a member of a group. And he was a great leader in his own way. But that was something that held him back a lot in his younger days, was hitching his wagon to the wrong mule time and time again. Mm. And not ever taking that step and being a leader until later in his years. So that was always his primary advice to me, was to encapsulate what I do and go and do it and be the leader. Because if I am the leader, I'm the only one that can let me down.
Yep. Yeah, and it just allows you to follow come up with a path that can be a little bit more forward-looking, rather than five or six people bickering over you know, where they'd like to tour next year.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, then again, you know, to hear me talk, I'm not like James Brown. You know, I don't make my guys wear suits in their bunks and go into the gas station with suits. It's really not that strict of an environment. I don't want to use too, you know, colorful language here, but the main rules on our bus is don't be an asshole. Don't dress like an asshole.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
Anything else is pretty cool.
You mentioned, though, being able to put them in a position where all they have to do is just show up, hit their mark, and punch a check. And what I would tell to every musician who's in a band doing that is that the guy that's making the decisions, what he's actually dreaming of is being the bass player in a band and just punching a check and not worried about how many tickets, you know, what's pre-sale for tonight? Did we get in the local paper? You know, yada, yada, yada.
Right. I mean, I've always said if I could do it all again, I'd just be a bass player. Maybe.
But for a very successful band. Yeah, for sure. So talk to me a bit about, you know, you got your start there. It sounds like it started regional, then it got more national. And then eventually you end up in Nashville making a pair of records, one with Dave Cobb, one with Dan Auerbach. How did you end up in Nashville making those records? What made you decide to go there and make your records there? And what did you learn from going there, from going to Music City to work?
Man, we got our first label deal up here with Fantasy Records, and that was like 6 years ago or so. So we always kind of come up here, and William Morris was the first people that ever took any interest in us and really helped us get on our feet. And it kind of grew from there. So we were always kind of coming up here every now and again, and we'd play at the Basement, and we did our showcase at the Basement East. There was about 13 people there, and Brittany Howard was one of those people, which I thought was pretty funny.
Nice.
And it was an interesting night, but I always kind of had a love affair with this town. You know, I love Nashville, and I've described the energy of this city as being, you know, contagious. It's kinetic. When you live on the road and that your living is putting all of your energy out, you come back to a town that has this just buzzing kinetic energy. It's a good place to plug back in and kind of charge yourself back up. So that's what I've always loved about this town. And the first lengthy period I spent here was when we did the record with Dave Cobb that you mentioned. And, you know, it was like 2 or 3 weeks, but I got a good handle on what it would be like to live here and to drive around and how the commute was, and mm-hmm. really just kind of fell in love with it. It's an industry town, but it feels like South Carolina to me. And it's the closest industry town I could get to that still had sweet tea. That was my main rule.
There you go. That's all. And so what was it like working in the studio with Dave Cobb that's done a lot of stuff? Did you find yourself, were there things that you had to catch up with that you struggled to keep up with? Did it feel natural? Was there a learning curve? What was the experience like?
I think the experience with me and Dave was top notch, man. We couldn't have asked for a better working environment. Me and Dave hit it off like gangbusters. And we're still good buddies. And I love the way that he works. And when you go into a situation like that, to me, I mean, you always need to check your ego at the door. That's a given. But when you're going in to work with a producer of that caliber, you know, you've hired them on for a reason. It's because they have something to say that you brought them in to say. You know what I mean? So questioning their every move is not going to be, it's not going to make for a healthy work environment, and it's not going to make for a good record. So I knew that going in, and I think Dave respected that. I think there was a mutual respect in that working process. I think there was a learning curve with the band as far as taking instruction from a producer to that degree. I think there's a learning curve there, but obviously they, you know, put in the work, and they we yielded some great results, man, and the band really, you know, did a number on that record. But working with Dave was one thing, but then working with Auerbach was a completely other thing. It was like polar opposites, both fantastic producers, but just really different approaches, and it's kind of both sides of the coin. Dave likes to get started about 2 p.m., after lunch, and Dan gets started about 9 a.m., but that's because everybody in his band's at least 75. The youngest guy there is about 75, and that's Dave Rowe, bass player. So they already had their breakfast, and they're ready to go at 9, you know?
Yeah, man. They've been up for 5 hours at that point. They're ready to roll.
That's midday. That's a midday session.
Right, right. Wow, that's a trip. Yeah, I've heard that his house band is on the elderly side. So what was it like working with those guys? They obviously have a wealth of talent, a wealth of experience that you could draw from. What did you learn from those dudes?
Man, I'd have a better shot saying what I didn't learn from those guys. Mm. I mean, I was just so blown away that that's his band, you know? For one, the studio and environment that they've worked in since they were my age or younger has preserved them in a way that they're just, they have more energy and just more just creative. I don't even know how to put it into words, man. Their energy is just contagious, and they seem younger than me to be 8 years old. And he's got two of the Memphis boys in there, Gene Chrisman and Bobby Wood, and they played on like Suspicious Minds. So, I mean, to be on the records that they've been on and to still just be the kind Southern gentleman that they are, that blew me away. And obviously Dave Rowe was Jerry Reed's son-in-law and bass player. And Billy Sanford played guitar on the record. And his second session in Nashville was Pretty Woman, and he wrote the riff for that song in the session. So the hitters in there were just, you know, astonishing to me, and they were really stoked to be working on my album, which I was really stoked to be working with them. So that energy, to go back to that again, it's just this town, man. Those kind of situations just kind of happen. And, you know, it was with that band, again, I was lucky enough to play on this session that Prime was doing over there, and I just got to play slide on this song. And I got to be part of that band for, you know, one session, which to me, that got me more giddy than them playing on my session, if that makes sense.
Yes.
To be a part of them and to read a chart with those guys, that meant a lot to me. And, you know, I wouldn't trade any of that for anything ever.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's really you getting to dip your finger in the river of history and realize that you're dropping it. You know, that's just a beautiful thing.
Yeah, man.
And for those guys, I mean, being able to reach their late 70s and 80s and having just made a living doing creative work, I mean, that's winning the game there. You have won the game if you make it into your 80s and all you've done is creative work your entire life. You won.
Mm-hmm. And they still just want to write and they still just want to create. I hope to be like those guys when I get up there.
What was so then how did Auerbach run the session with those guys and with you, and how is it different than past processes that you've done?
Man, I've described Dan quite often as like a Captain Ahab, man. You know, he just kind of sits at the helm and he trusts his crew and he trusts his his ship. So he just kind of stands there at the helm, and he played on the whole record too, but you know, he just has such a foresight for everything that's to come. You know, like he just sees ahead to what this one little ripple, what it's going to affect down the road. You know, if we do this now, how will it be heard in generations to come?
Mm.
And that's what I really respect about him as a producer. He can see for miles, is the way I've always put it.
Yeah. I remember he did. Did you ever listen to that Dr. John album he did 6 or 7 years ago?
Lockdown. Yes, sir.
Man, that was the first thing that I heard that he produced. And I'd always been a fan of the Black Keys stuff. But then I was like, wow, this is like a generational talent in the producer's chair here, man, to be able to produce something like that for Dr. John, man.
You're not lying, man. And Dan's tenacity of getting that record done was what blew me away. Just trying to get in touch to him with Mac Rebinac, trying to get in touch with him to the point of just driving to New Orleans and tracking him down and just knocking on his door. That is heavy, man. That's heavy.
It is. Do you think, obviously you got a lot of playing and touring ahead of you. Do you think that you'll end up producing and doing session stuff, or do you think your life is mainly going to be on the stage and performing and being in the spotlight there?
Well, you know, man, I just have so many producers that I've worked with and that I admire and that I look up to and that have kind of shown me the path in a way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I've built a studio here at my home in Tennessee, and I do look forward to producing some acts, and I'm actually stepping into the producer's chair for the first time early next year. So we'll see what happens, or if it's for me at least.
Oh, man, it's going to be fun, and it's going to take some of the sting off having to have been off the road for a little while to be able to step into that position.
Right.
Well, right on, man. Well, dude, thanks so much for sitting down and rapping with our show this week. And yeah, man, when all this COVID madness is over, I look forward to coming out and catching a Marcus King show sometime, brother.
Absolutely, man. Well, thanks so much for having me on.
Okay, take it easy.
All right, take care.
This week's show is brought to you by Bandzoogl. Built by musicians and for musicians, Bandzoogl is an all-in-one platform to build a beautiful website for your music. Use promo code TWS, the initials of our podcast, TWS, to get 15% off the first year of any subscription. Marcus King's latest album is entitled El Dorado, available everywhere music is sold or streamed. If before we meet again you sit down to write, please remember, an expensive drug habit is not a song. A compelling Instagram account is not a song. And most importantly, reverb is not a song. So let all that take care of itself. And for you, just keep your eye on the song.